Welcome to the Quest Podcast, proudly presented by the Muscular Dystrophy Association as part of the Quest family of content. I'm your host, Mindy Henderson. Together, we are here to bring thoughtful conversation to the neuromuscular disease community and beyond about issues affecting those with neuromuscular disease and other disabilities and those who love them. We are here for you to educate and inform, to demystify, to inspire, and to entertain. We are here shining a light on all that makes you, you. Whether you are one of us, love someone who is, or are on another journey altogether, thanks for joining. Now let's get started.
Ken Sutcliffe dedicated his career to saving lives as a U.S. Army veteran and as a firefighter. He never thought that one day he'd be fighting for his own. Today, I am so proud to introduce you to Ken, who was diagnosed with amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, or ALS, also known as Lou Gehrig's disease, and his wife of 13 years, Andy. I had the great pleasure of speaking with both of them a week or two ago, and they quickly became two of my favorite people on the planet. Their strength and positive outlooks are infectious, and not only were they both heroes in their careers, but they continue to be heroes to so many as they spend their time raising awareness for ALS and raising money for research. Ken, Andy, I am so happy to have you here today and to have what I know is going to be a wonderful conversation.
We're so excited to be here and thank you for
having
us.
Thank you, Mindy. It's our pleasure.
Thank you. Well, I'm going to jump right in. You two have such an interesting story of how you met and some of the incredible work that you've done together. Can you tell us a little bit about your love story and how it all came together?
I'll be happy to start it. Andy can jump in, but most firemen have a second job. They have a side hustle. Since you work for us, it was 24 hours on, 48 off. And mine was working for movers. And they'd let me know the day before where I needed to be to help do moving. And got a call to go to an address to help do some moving. And lo and behold, little did I know, I was going to meet the wife of my life that day, moving her out of the house she was in and into another house. So we met moving. I don't know. What can you add to that, my love?
Well, the love story continues. He pursued me for almost a year and would send me flowers, and they would say, "Patiently waiting, Fireman Ken," which was adorable but annoying at the same time. I was raising my youngest son, and my focus at that time was just on my son. But how Ken won me over was I'm a huge hockey fan, and he offered to take me to a Stars hockey game. And finally, after a year, I agreed, and I said yes. So that's kind of how it all began.
I love it.
Our first date was a hockey game with hockey fights and hot dogs and popcorn and everything else. And we had a wonderful time.
That sounds like a perfect first date. Now, if I'm not mistaken, didn't you both also maybe work together on the search and rescue teams?
We did.
Yes, we did. this was after, of course, when we both got onto the search and rescue teams. This was after we met. Where I was working was the technical rescue station for the city of Dallas at the time. Mm-hmm. And we did all high angle, low angle, confined space, any kind of rescue that a normal engine or truck company could not handle on their own.
Wow.
They would call us in to do it. And because of that, we had once urban search and rescue team in the entire state of Texas at the time. And that urban search and rescue team was Texas Task Force One. Well, lo and behold, of course, they were deployed one day, and the governor decided, you know what, I need more search and rescue assets. So he tasked Dallas Fire Department to step up and create a urban search and rescue team.
Oh, wow.
And that's how I ended up on a urban search and rescue team and became a member of that. And then later on, we brought Andy aboard And kicking, screaming, I might add.
Okay, let's clarify this. So Ken came to me and told me they were going to get 4 new dogs. I was an EMT, and at one point I had done my training and then volunteered as a victim for search and rescue dogs. And I thought, what a great combination, you know, the dog, the medical aspect. And so I applied through the National Disaster Search Dog Foundation out in California and interviewed. And I have to say, in my interview, it was with the Dallas Fire Rescue because they were the sponsoring agency. I felt like you have to bring your significant other. Ken pretty much stole the conversation. And at one point I'm like, is this interview for me or is it for you? Fortunately, I was selected. And so from there began my career as a disaster search and rescue canine handler. And I was a member of Texas Task Force 2 and worked in the program office. And then also part of Texas Task Force 1. So that's kind of our love for the search and rescue. We both, Ken was a search team manager on a deployment. He was my boss.
And tricky.
And he'll say no, but he was. And then, so we got to deploy a couple times together, but for the most part, we both had a love for search and rescue and just to give back and to help other people. And I think for me, it all happened when 9/11 happened and I wanted to be able to do something. Didn't have the qualifications for most things, but I knew the dog was an avenue to get me to be able to help and do that kind of stuff. And through Ken and Dallas Fire Rescue, I was able to achieve that. So it was great.
That's incredible. I can't imagine hard, I'm sure, very difficult work, but also I would think such rewarding work.
Completely. I would tell Ken, I said, when I was sweaty, dirty, and, you know, sitting there and getting dirty with the dogs and training when it's 120 on the concrete, that was my best time. It was, again, it was hard work. It was rewarding, but I wouldn't have changed it for, just like him in the fire department, wouldn't have changed it for anything in the world.
Yeah.
And it was a great bonding for us too. We obviously became closer. We weren't married at that time. So it was great for both of us.
Yeah. I got to carry all her bags.
Oh, I love it.
I was her porter.
Yep. Well, I don't do search and rescue, of course, but I do make my husband carry my bags every chance I get.
There you go.
So, sounds like a good man.
Yeah, he's pretty good. He's pretty great. I'm going to keep him. So, Ken, you served, like I said, both in the military and as a firefighter, and of course, on the search and rescue teams. And first of all, let me say thank you for your service. That's incredible. Can you tell us briefly about, I know that there's a lot potentially to unpack there, and I think that you spent a number of years doing both things, but can you tell us a little bit about your experiences in the military and as a firefighter, what you did, where you went, how long you served, all of that?
Yeah, I would be happy to. I joined the Army at age 17. My mother had to sign on the dotted line because if you're less than 18, you can't join the military without your parents' signature. I joined the Army in June of 1980. I went active duty in September of 1980. Basic training at Fort Knox. I went in to be what was at the time called a Cav Scout or a Cavalry Scout. And our essentially your job was to go out ahead of just like in the old days, you had to have scouts out front to figure out what's going on and what's happening and where the enemy is. So the job of the cavalry scout in the modern day Army in the 80s was to be out front of everybody else, find and fix the enemy's position, and be able to report back and let them know where they were. Did my basic training for about 4 months, graduated out of basic and my advanced training. I went overseas to Germany. Spent 2 years in Germany with the 2nd Cavalry Regiment. Our job there was to patrol the Czechoslovakian/East German border. And so we would do border tours every 4 weeks, or you would go up about every month, one week for a month, go up there and you would drive gun jeeps along the border with Czechoslovakia, make sure the fence and everything was intact and whatever else. After that, I was brought back to the United States, went to 5th Infantry Division at Fort Polk, Louisiana. I scouted there for 2 years attempted to get into helicopter flight school, which required me to extend for a year, was unable to at that time based on just the needs of the Army. So I got out of the Army active duty after 5 years, went ahead and decided that I wanted to move on with something else, which was becoming a firefighter. And I went to college. I had to have 45 hours of college for Dallas Fire Department. Went ahead and got that accomplished and joined the Dallas Fire Department in, tested for them in April of 87 and joined in June of 87. And spent 33 years working for Dallas Fire Department. I stayed as a firefighter, rode the tailboard or the back of the apparatus, put out fires, took care of car wrecks, went to paramedic school, rode the ambulance for 12 years, and then moved into the technical rescue aspect of the job. And I worked in the technical rescue aspect and search and rescue for the last probably 15 years of my career. And I retired in June of 2020 after 33 years on the fire department.
Wow. And, you know, I've got to say the irony is not lost on me that you were out there filling the boot as a firefighter for MDA. And, you know, little did you know that this was in your future. Is that just, I mean, do you just do the V8 head slap?
Oh, yeah. You're like, you know, I did it for 33 years. I mean, we did it every year.
Yeah.
Except for COVID, you know, the last couple of years of my, before I retired with COVID and everything else, it stopped. But for at least 30 years, every spring we were out filling the boot. And of course, with the fire department, it becomes a competition. And it was to see who could, what station, what shift could raise the most money for MDA. And so we worked, you know, that was the big thing. And so everybody tried to push. And our station, when I was working at Station 15, we became, I think, 2 years in a row, we won, beat everybody in the city for collecting money.
Wow.
And it's fun. And we enjoyed it, had a good time. You met people, you got to talk to them for a second at the lights, and you just go around and people would dump every bit of money they had, change, stuff like that. So
amazing. And it's fun, you say, and I believe you. I'm sure that it's tons of fun. Also, I would guess hot, because you hail from Texas, which is toasty. I'm also in Texas. And so do you smolder in your uniforms the whole time?
Yeah, so a lot of times we would end up collecting. You'd start out like wearing bunker pants and a t-shirt, trying to make everybody, you know, like, oh, it's the fireman. And then by midday you were down to pants.
Yeah.
And then and then if you had shorts by the afternoon, you could change into your duty shorts.
Okay.
It would get very, very hot out there, and especially in the late spring, early summer.
That's amazing. Well, as someone living with spinal muscular atrophy, again, I say thank you for all the years that you spent doing that. The amount of money the firefighters raise just blows my mind all the time. Ken, I told you when we spoke last week that you have the energy of, and I haven't known you long, but it's impossible to miss. You just have the energy of a calm and solid leader. Does that come from your experience in the service and as a firefighter, or has that always been who you are?
Well,
a combination of
all three, probably. I mean, I just have been always able to, for whatever reason, be calm when everything around me is going 1,000 miles an hour. I've always been able to be calm and be able to critically think. And the military, I think I honed my skills there. And then on the fire ground, I mean, at first, you know, you're told what you need to do, but then as you get more experience, you know what you need to do.
Yeah.
And then pretty soon, as you get older, you fall into that teaching position where you're helping the younger guys learn. Mm. And so it gives you the ability to just lead, even if you are not an officer, you're mm-hmm. leading the younger guys, especially when you're a senior firefighter. And, you know, and you always, I always led by example. If,
yeah,
you know, if I can do this, you can do this, and let's get it done.
Amazing. Amazing. And I'm going to shift gears a little bit now and talk about your diagnostic journey and how all of that has unfolded. But I suspect that that's a quality, you know, the sort of calm tendencies and strength and leadership. I suspect they've come in handy in your newest sort of battle in life as someone living with ALS.
It has. I mean, my diagnostic journey was, I retired in June of 20, December of 20, I was out in the garage reaching up to get a cooler off the top shelf. And you don't ever think about it, you just reach up and get a cooler. Mm-hmm. So I reached up and grabbed a cooler, except my left arm didn't go all the way up. And I kind of was like, why? It's like it stopped about 3 inches before my right arm. Mm-hmm. So I told myself, all right, left arm, go up. And it went up like it should. And I was like, weird. Yeah. You know, and I didn't think much of it that day. But later on, I started to get a little bit of twitching in my biceps. And I was like, well, need to take a nap, eat more potassium. Something's, you know, they went away. And finally, I noticed that the left arm was becoming more not reaching up higher. Mm-hmm. And so I went to my regular doctor. And they were like, well, let's go have them look at your left shoulder where it started. Mm-hmm. Went to that doctor. He did a series of tests. And it's a disease that essentially is diagnosed by ruling out everything else.
Right.
There are tests that they use to help diagnose it.
Okay.
There is no definitive test for ALS.
And so you shared with me that your particular occurrence of ALS is not genetic, correct?
Correct. It is not. It is not genetic. No one in my family had a history of anything. No neuro. My mother had Parkinson's, and that's it.
Okay. Okay. So can you tell me a little bit about what the progression has been like and how you're doing now?
Sure. When I was diagnosed in November of 21, I had lost a lot of use of my arms, both of them, the left and the right. Mm. I mean, I could still use my hands normally, my lower arms, but I couldn't lift either arm up very well at all.
Yeah.
Then I went, from that point, the arms continued to get more and more weak, mm-hmm. Less useful. By the time I got into the spring of 22, they really weren't working at all, right, babe? Kind of.
Mm-hmm. You could eat, but it was really, I mean, it got to the point where he needed full assistance eventually.
Yeah.
But you were still working at that point. He was an instructor across the country for Texas A&M, teaching disasters in the community. Yeah. And
oh, wow.
Wide area search.
Wide area search. So he traveled all over the country and was still able to do it till finally got to that point where he just couldn't anymore.
Right.
And that was a hard day for him to give that up, especially being in the military, then mm-hmm. firefighter, and then on the task force, and then teaching disasters, you know, how to survive in a disaster in a community or for public servants, and then to not be able to do it anymore was really tough. It was a really hard day.
I bet. I can. Yeah. And Andy, I have to imagine for you as well as Ken's wife, you know, that it would be, I mean, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but I suspect it would be such a helpless feeling to watch this unfold.
It's devastating.
Yeah.
And it hurts me because I've watched this strong man for the little bit of time that I've known him, although I feel like I've known him a lifetime.
Yeah.
And heard about his accomplishments, seen his accomplishments, mm-hmm. and then to see him go to sitting in a chair and being uncomfortable or not being able to move, not being able to do for himself when this, and he jokes about carrying my bags, but he literally would come and train with us just to come and be around me and Sky, my partner Sky, and would help carry stuff. And to, he always said one day that he felt like he would have to take care of me. Mm-hmm. And God said, oh,
that
no.
That was the plan. That's the plan I had anyway.
And so his little plan didn't work out as he thought it would. And so it's tough. It's tough to watch him knowing what he was, grieving the person that he was and grieving the person that he's going to be is what's
right.
Really
tough. Right. Right. So Ken, are you ambulatory at this point or?
No, it moved from my arms down to my hips. And little did I know that I always thought you stood up with your legs, but evidently use far more hip muscle than you know.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah,
I wouldn't know.
Yeah, and it started working on the hip muscles, and pretty soon I could not. I was always hard getting out of chairs. I could still walk, but it was kind of a weird gait that I had at the time. And I mean, eventually the legs started to become weaker, and it just was silly to try to do anything like that anymore.
Yeah.
Albeit, I was stubborn as a mule. I was going to try to stand and try to do this, but after about five falls, I figured it was probably time to give all that up. So now at this point, I'm wheelchair bound or I'm bed bound. It just depends.
Okay.
I use a Hoyer lift to get me out of bed in the morning and put me in bed at night. I use the Hoyer lift to put me in the chair. Mm-hmm. I use the Hoyer lift to put me in my shower chair so I can take a shower. Be wheeled into the shower and take a shower. So there's a lot of things that I have lost, but I also feel like there's things I've gained, and that is just a different perspective on what quality of life was.
Yeah.
At one time I would have thought, oh, I don't want that. You know, that's not a good quality of life. Mm-hmm. But I'm going to tell you what, it's not bad.
Yeah.
I'm not going to complain because it's life, and that's the best part about it.
Very well said. So well said. You know, there for people who are listening who may be going through any kind of neuromuscular condition, which is typically progressive, you know, there could be people listening who are losing function and going through that themselves. You kind of went there a little bit. I loved your perspective shift, but is there any other advice you would give to people who are going through that and maybe struggling with the emotional aspects of it?
It's not easy.
Yeah.
I'll say that. But I will say that you have two options. You can move forward and you can greet each day as it's a great day.
Mm-hmm.
Or there are some folks who just curl up and can't face anything. And I feel I feel absolutely horrible for those people.
Yeah.
And I'm just the kind of person, because of what I've done my whole life, it's like, okay, well, we have a challenge. How do we fix this? How do we mitigate it? How do we move forward? What do we do to face this challenge?
Mm-hmm.
And I try to do that. I try to do that every day. Go ahead, babe.
I was just going to say, Mindy, one of the things that we've learned to lean on is family, friends, resources, MDA, networking groups, anything that you can join or be a part of, because like Ken said, that wasn't in the ALS handbook that we weren't given.
Right.
Everything is so different that you don't know what to expect. So learning from other people who've experienced it, everybody's experience is so totally different.
Mm-hmm.
But just leaning on those people to learn what you can learn and how to navigate the rough days, how to navigate the days where you need a little bit more equipment, the things that you don't think you need.
Right.
You wait too long and all of a sudden it's too late. You need it 5 weeks prior.
Yes.
And then family. Our family and friends are such a strong tribe and community for us. Nice. And Ken's firefighter buddies, they come over, they're here if you need anything. And I would say pridefully, probably in the beginning, we didn't lean on anybody. And you're like, I'm good. You're not good. And right. I think if you keep it in, you're suffering in silence, where mm-hmm. you could be reaching out to get help, whether it's professional or family or friends or whatever, other resources are available. It's paramount. You need it because that's what gets you through the tough days. It gets you through the good days.
Right.
But just giving up and letting go and letting other people help you, I think, is one of the most important things. And again, research. Start from the beginning, even though it's like down the road, I won't need this for a while.
Right.
When you need it, it's usually a little bit too late. So.
Right.
And I think that's just part of the journey.
Yeah, very good point. And, you know, there are a lot of things that could fall into the category of what you're talking about. But I will say durable medical equipment, post-COVID, the timelines for getting what you need in that area, it takes forever. So you're 100% right in so many different ways. But I have to go there and say, start that process now.
You do. Yeah. Like I said, we learned the hard way that you wait and it's too late. I mean, you could have, it's just like the wheelchair. Ken never thought he'd be in a wheelchair. So we kind of pushed that off. Mm-hmm. And once we realized he was going to be in a wheelchair to get fitted for it, to wait for it to come in, like you said, all that took time. And he actually should have been in the wheelchair sooner than we were able to get him into one. So lesson learned.
Who knew they fitted you for wheelchairs?
Sure.
I mean, obviously I just thought you go, I need a wheelchair, and one shows up.
Right, exactly.
No, not the case whatsoever.
Or you order one off of Amazon or something.
Oh, my wheelchair's here. Not that.
Not how it works. No. Andy, you probably didn't expect to be in a caregiver role at this point in your life and in your marriage. What's life been like for you? What advice would you give to other partners or spouses out there, again, who might be listening?
I will say it's not easy, and I don't pretend that it's easy. And again, that's when I lean on family and friends and support for whatever I need. But also, it is hard to sit and watch them. So for me, it's just like the airplane. You have a child with you, you put on the mask first. So you have to take care of yourself first. Mm-hmm. I see a therapist, and it helps me get through the grieving process or processing things, which I couldn't on my own figure out. You know, I thought I was strong and I could do it. You know, I could do the dog thing. I could do this, but that it's a whole different beast. And so to be able to talk to somebody and help them work you through your issues is paramount. Again, it's just, like I said, I didn't think I'd ever have to be a caregiver, but I don't know how to explain it. It's kind of like my boys. It's like they fight to take the control of the wheelchair to help Ken. Mm-hmm. Everybody wants to help Ken. He's such a positive and good human being that you want to do for him. I love him, obviously, and there wouldn't be anything I wouldn't do for him. I hear, you know, he was got out of the hospital last week for a short stint. Mm-hmm. I didn't leave his side because I wanted to make sure, because even the medical professionals, everybody, they don't always know what ALS entails. They know it's you know, neuromuscular, but they don't realize this shoulders, you can't grab the shoulders or those sublux or just the little things that I had to be there, or even a Hoyer lift, putting on a sling. You'd be surprised how many people in the medical profession don't know how to cross the legs, and literally he could fall right through. So I've learned to be a strong advocate for him and do my research so that I can protect him. It's just like mama bear, you know, you have your children or people you love. I mean, you do, you step up and you're very protective, and you're in that fierce protective mode, and you'll do whatever you can. And again, it's not what you expect, but you know, one day I think I'll probably sit back and breathe for a minute, but until then I'm here to fight for him and with him as long as we're in the fight.
That's amazing. And I love that you noted that you're taking care of yourself too, by going to therapy and all of that. And I think it's such an important point. Again, even if you feel like you're doing fine and you don't think that you need it, I think it's good to get ahead of it and maybe get it before you think you're going to need it.
And just on the bad days, it's not going to solve the problem.
Yeah.
But just to help navigate it and think through things and you know, get help, just to talk to somebody. Because again,
remember the day I got diagnosed and that therapist came in?
The therapist looked at me, he goes, what did he say? You okay?
Yeah, he looked at me and he goes, are you okay? And I said, Yeah. Kind of like questioning, like, why would you even ask me that question?
Yeah.
After I'm being diagnosed.
Right.
First, Andy wasn't okay.
He goes, are you okay? I couldn't breathe. I couldn't talk. I literally could not get a word out of my mouth. And the ironic thing is Ken had me log into the portal for the medical profession for the test results. And so real time, I'm watching these tests come in, researching the tests to see what they mean. So I kind of knew. And Ken, like he told him, he goes, I'd be surprised if you told me I didn't have ALS. Mm-hmm. But again, there's no hard test that shows it. But all these other small tests that they do, I could tell that that's where we were headed.
Yeah.
And just to have somebody say it, like I said, I literally could not breathe or get a word out of my mouth and just sat there and cried.
Yeah.
And then again, had to go home and process it. So
sure.
Nobody expects to hear that. I mean, Ken says he did, but I think still in some way it was probably a little bit of a shock to you.
Yeah. I mean, it's a shock. And I'll say it this way. I would have been surprised to find out that I didn't have ALS, but when they say it still, it's still a gut punch.
Yes.
There's no doubt about it. I mean, I may have thought that I had ALS, but you know what? There's still that tiny little bit of you.
Yes.
Maybe not.
Well, you know? And it's not real until someone says it out loud. And so, I totally get what you're saying. And, you know, I'm just having, you know, I've had moments in my life where just, you know, the world around you kind of goes fuzzy and, you know, nothing feels real anymore. And you're just sitting in this state of shock.
And see, you get it, you understand. The thing is, too, also, I think people don't realize, even though you get that diagnosis and you're told this, like for us, it's never a quit. You don't quit just because you have that diagnosis. You keep pushing. Mm-hmm. And again, like MDA, Fill the Boot, or any other opportunity to fundraise to get research, because that research is so important and valuable.
Right.
It's just like any other disease. You don't know what one day, what one test, what $1 is going to make a difference and find a cure. So you hold out hope. And never give up, because if you give up, you're letting yourself down, your family down, and your community, the ALS community, because everybody is in the fight together. And so I think as long as you keep fighting, there's still that small bit of hope.
Absolutely. And, you know, working for MDA, I see it firsthand. You know, we write the blogs and the press releases and things when drug approvals happen, you know, and it feels like such a floodgate has been opened of medicines and therapies and things that are helping people with different conditions, ALS included. And it, you know, and it's becoming a much more frequent occurrence that we see things getting approved and into the hands of the people that need them. So absolutely. I think that, you know, it's easy for me to say and maybe harder to do when you're facing something like ALS, but I think there's every reason to hope, you know?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
And that's the thing, it's hard to do. I think a lot of people, like Ken mentioned, some of them just give up. They don't want to dive into the fact that they have ALS. Where for us, and for Ken especially, like Ken feels like, you know, this may not be his time to find or be a part of that cure. But if he can help somebody else, and same with us, we want to be able to be proactive and help people who are maybe just starting their journey with ALS to help fight the fight. Because, again, you don't know what the result's going to be and when it's going to be. So we're going to do whatever we can until his last breath to make sure that we can help fight along with everybody else to help find a cure for this.
Y'all are amazing. I know. Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about what's been helpful to you. You know, this is, of course, it's different for everybody, but it's a relatively rapidly progressing illness, which means that your needs change rapidly as well. So what are the resources, the tools, things that you found helpful and impactful in making your life easier or in maintaining your independence?
I think Andy will agree with me on this. And that was The first and most important thing is you've got to reach out to an organization and learn, because you don't know what you don't know. Mm-hmm. So you start thinking you know what you're supposed to be doing.
Yeah.
And you don't. They give you a diagnosis, but they don't, there's no handbook.
Yeah.
As I joke.
Wouldn't that be nice?
Yeah. There's no handbook on steps you need to do. Mm-hmm. And so you need to reach out, find out, get the information, learn what's out there to help you, learn what's out there to give you information and guide you. Mm-hmm. Those things are paramount. Wouldn't you agree, Heather?
Yeah, and utilize them. You know, there's a lot of networking groups, and to be honest with you, that might not be the match for somebody. It might not right. be the thing to go. And to be perfectly honest with you, I follow a lot of groups on Facebook. Now, uh-huh. am I actively involved? Not necessarily, but I will take information from it and yeah. utilize that information. Doesn't mean you have to be a part of it. You know, a lot of people share. I'm not one typically to get onto a site that I don't know somebody.
Yeah.
Like for this, again, we want to be as brutally honest as we can.
Yeah.
Again, to hopefully help somebody. And if mm-hmm. it helps one person, that's a win.
And I mean, new medications are out there. There's trials out there.
Trials, mm-hmm.
I mean, especially in the very beginning when you're first diagnosed, find out what trials are available to you.
Because yes.
as this disease progresses, you become less eligible for trials. Yes.
Right. That's a really good point. I'm glad you said that.
Because you don't realize that until, oh, yeah, no, we can't. Yeah, sorry, you can't come in this trial because right. you can't move this or you can't do that.
Mm-hmm.
And so it getting into that right off the bat's important.
And I would say too, like our doctor, like we would hear about medications and present it to her and say, what about this medicine?
Right.
Because they don't always offer it to you. Uh-huh. And I don't know if that's just doctor to doctor, it's different.
Yeah.
But also I know that if a doctor is doing, has part of a study, they're more likely going to grab their patients. So mm-hmm. you have to be proactive again and do your research, find out what studies are out there. And there's a national website or registry that you can go and look and see what studies are out there.
Mm-hmm.
And then reach out yourself, because you have to be your very best advocate.
Yes.
Because again, you know, doctors are going to take care of people in their hospital, their groups, and there might be one that you don't have to go in all the time, or maybe one closer to you. So mm-hmm. again, do your research and go to those registries and see what's available and then ask.
Absolutely. And there are things happening now, you know, wearable devices and all sorts of things that they're trying to do in the clinical trial world right now to make it easier for people to participate.
Right.
And so, I think that there's so much that could be a possibility. And we'll make sure in the show notes that we put the link to the clinical trials and things so that people That's can awesome. Go take a look. Yeah. What about, you know, things like equipment or home modifications or electronics, anything that's been like a game changer for you that you,
what would you think would be the biggest game changer,
really? So, you know, again, it's you do your research and ask. So one of the couple of things Ken's on, obviously the muscles, diaphragm are affected. So mm-hmm. he does a cough assist, which uh-huh. helps strengthen his diaphragm. Reaching out to groups like IMALS and muscular dystrophy, all those places that can give you resources. Another one that we've just gotten and that he's going to start working on is called an eye gaze. So he's uh-huh. going to start voice banking, which will literally be his own voice should he lose his voice, which mm-hmm. again, there's no guarantee. But again, this is one of those things that you need to get on right away.
Yeah, if you wait too late, you can't talk.
Right. And with a computer, he would be able to track with his eyes and it would talk using his voice. And again, that's something you might need, you might not need, but you don't want to wait because then the option may not be available to you. So that's one.
Learning how to set your iPhones or your Android devices so that you can answer them with your voice and things like that, or send texts just by using your voice. And those options are in both of them that allow you to flip switches that allow you to answer your phone by saying, you know, hey, Alexa, hey, Siri, whatever.
Because he's unable to use his hands.
Yeah.
So just little things like that. You know, one of the things that we learned from another ALS group, it's kind of cute. So their feet, you know, the wheelchair pads are hard. So one of the patients was told by a therapist to put those car wash mitts on it. And so the car wash mitt fits on each one and it's padded and it's soft. So whether you're standing on it or not, you've got your feet resting so you don't get pressure sores. That's another thing is pressure sores, being able to have somebody who knows what to do or constantly moving, because once you get those pressure sores, that's a hard deal to get cleaned up. And obviously, whether you're wheelchair bound or not, it can be debilitating in a
very short period of time.
Yes.
That's infective.
Yeah. So again, you know, stuff like that, the eyes, the padding, elbow pads, like he has these little Sherpa, like sheepskin. You can get bandages that cover the heel pads or elbows, but to rest on it, it's like a, like sheepskin. And it just, we put it on him, Velcro him on, and it protects his elbows.
Brilliant.
So he doesn't get pressed sure. Same with his heels. There's just a lot.
Yeah.
And again, wheelchairs ask, because Ken's upper body has become increasingly weaker. And so from side to side, his motion. So now we've got the wheelchair that wraps around on the side a little bit more to give him some more support, and waiting on a head one, a headrest that's a little bit different that wraps around to protect the side of his head. So we're in the car, he's jostling around. It'll help stabilize him more. So the thing I would say about all that stuff is ask. Okay,
yes.
This is what I'm experiencing. What's available? Tell them what your symptoms are, what you're going through. And they're going to go, oh, I've got a fix for that. Let's try this.
Yeah. That car wash mitt thing is genius.
Yes.
I might steal that.
And you know what? We lower his chair and let him clean the floors too.
Yes.
I drive around with my mitts and I dust the floors.
I love it. Perfect.
It's just for comfort and ease. It's a great thing. It really is. So little things like that.
Yeah. That's incredible. I'm going to go back just for one second to, you know, being a veteran and being a firefighter. And is it three times more likely that veterans and firefighters will develop ALS?
2 to 3 times.
Yeah. 2 to 3 times more likely than the regular.
And both. Population.
Okay. So I asked you this question a week or two ago, and you gave such a beautiful answer. I'm going to ask it again. If you had known then what you know now, would you have changed your path?
No. And that's the simple answer. But the longer answer is, yeah, I mean, you're not going to not think about it, right? But here's the thing. I grew up wanting to be an army man or a fireman.
Mm-hmm.
And I was blessed to do both in my life.
Wow.
I never had a job. I never worked. I was in the army and I was on the fire department, and they were both ways of life. So I never had to ever, I always was happy to go to work or order the job.
Yeah.
And I would also say that I was born to do this. So had I chose any other career path, I feel like I would have been miserable.
Yeah.
So going back and looking back now, given the my current state of affairs, I would have changed nothing, because I had 40 years of doing things I loved, as opposed to 40 years of mediocrity and being miserable.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure, and I'm not saying everybody is miserable in their job.
No.
But what I am saying, for me, I would have been not doing what I did.
This was the path that was meant for you, it sounds like.
And like he said, he never had to work a day in his life, because he enjoyed everything he did and wouldn't trade it for anything. And everybody asked him, and his answer, quick answer is no. I wouldn't change it.
Well, and I want to ask you this too, because, you know, there may be people, again, out there who are considering a career as a firefighter or in the military, and may pause because this information comes their way. But you also shared with me that, like, in the world of firefighting, there are things, again, because people like you who are spreading awareness, there are things that fire stations and different people are doing to take precautions. Can you talk a little about that?
Yeah, I can only speak to what Dallas has done.
Uh-huh.
But when I joined the Dallas Fire Department, we used to say on the fire department, well, back then the smoke was thicker and the fire was hotter, but it was a long coat, three-quarter boots, you know, you had an air pack, you know, but there were still guys who had fought fire that were working at the time that they didn't have air packs when they started, and they used sponges in their mouth, and they'd breathe through a wet sponge. So nowadays, the fire departments have become more aware of all kinds of possible diseases that have been associated with the job. ALS, of course, being number one of those. But it is, they've gone to buying extra sets of firefighting gear. So each fireman will have two sets of firefighting gear. So if on your shift, if you have a fire, you don't have to put the same wet, dirty, smoke-filled slash who knows what else filled from burning gear on. You put it on your fresh, clean set and finish your shift. In the meantime, you throw your dirty set into what they call an extractor. It's like a giant, It's like a giant washing machine that's like, beyond super heavy duty. It's like it's like comparing a shovel to an excavator.
Yeah.
When it comes to that stuff. And it washes everything. You bring it out and hang it to dry. Some of the other things they do now is when I joined after a fire, you know, you took your mask off, you overhauled in that smoky environment and cleaning out the burned rooms and stuff. Nowadays, you're required to wear your mask at all times when you're inside the burning building. Even though it's not burning anymore, when you're inside overhauling, you're required to wear your mask. And so
sounds wise.
There are many things that are coming along in the fire service to mitigate possible issues down the road for firefighters.
That's great. And, you know, and just, I know you said you could only speak for Dallas, but, you know, even by sharing this on the podcast today, you know, there may be people in New York who hear this and then they can go in and talk to their fire station about it and hopefully implement those same practices. So I think that's great.
Well, and I think thanks to the IAFF, International Association of Firefighters, I think that this has become nationwide now.
Yeah.
They have spread the news through, well, when we filled the boot, you learn stuff, and they've spread the news throughout, you know, their different locals that, hey, changes have to come, and they are, for sure.
Yes, absolutely. Gosh, I wish that I could talk to you guys all day long, but I have, I think, just one more question for you. You know, unfortunately, we all know the realities of ALS and your incredible people who have clearly contributed so much to the world around you and the people you love. There are a lot of people who love you both. Ken, what do you want your legacy to be?
I want my legacy to be somebody who handled this with grace and courage, and also was willing to take the time that he has left and bring awareness and bring hopefully other people who might think they don't have a chance to hear my voice and say, you know what? You do have a chance.
Yeah.
You do have a life. It's because the diagnosis, it's not over till it's over. Mm-hmm. And every day you open your eyes is a great day. And you have to move forward with faith and you have to move forward with conviction. Mm. And, you know, I mean,
never give up.
And I just hope that can show through me. And then the time I have left that I can, you know, bring awareness, do things, and hopefully one day they do find a cure for this disease. And, you know, it is a thing of the past, or at least it's a thing that once you do get a diagnosis, it can be treated.
Yeah.
And bringing awareness to it.
Absolutely, which you guys are both doing brilliantly. And I know that there are a lot of people out there who you're helping and who you will help, people that you'll never meet, that you're going to change the world for. So thank you so much for being here. It's been such a pleasure talking to you, and I count you as new friends in my life. And I'm just so grateful to have had this conversation with you.
Thank you for allowing us the opportunity too, because without being able to share this through podcasts or through other media resources or friends or whatever, the word's not going to get out. And I just think more opportunity. And like you said, somebody in another state might hear this and may change their life in one way or another, or they're willing to help in
their journey. So. I think it will, 100%. Well,
thank you so much, Mindy.
Thank you again.
And bless you with your journey as well, too.
Thank you. You're so sweet. I appreciate that.
Thank you for listening. For more information about the guests you heard from today, go check them out at mda.org/podcast. And to learn more about the Muscular Dystrophy Association, the services we provide, how you can get involved, and to subscribe to Quest Magazine or to Quest Newsletter, please go to mda.org/quest. If you enjoyed this episode, we'd be grateful if you'd leave a review. Go ahead and hit that subscribe button so we can keep bringing you great content, and maybe share it with a friend or two. Thanks, everyone. Until next time, go be the light we all need in this world.